This is the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 4th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your state society of CPAs. Well, this is the week of Star Wars Day. For those of you who don't get that, May the 4th be with you. That's the day for the Star Wars people to be happy about. So we'll be on Star Wars Day week. And as far as this week's session goes, we might as well have just called this current PPP loan developments, because this week has a ton of guidance that has come out about details of the Payroll Protection Program loans, but unfortunately not the guidance we're all really looking for, which is how exactly do we calculate forgiveness in the 8-week period. A lot of people have loans out now. Those people have the 8 weeks running. Those people need to spend it on the right stuff in the 8 weeks. And we are still waiting on anything from the SBA regarding how that one's going to work, aside from knowing that apparently there are going to be some rules, we just don't know what they are. But let's start about talking about what is going on this week and what we did find out, because we found out a few things this week. One thing which we did find out was a lot of guidance issued this week regarding various things with the PPP. And one of those, and these tend to be about things about maximum loans. It's kind of interesting. We're getting that this late in the game. But the Small Business Administration issued new interim final regulations, which, as I've said, for practical purposes, that's what tax calls temporary regulations, is what's called by most other agencies interim final regulations. And this is entitled the Business Loan Program Temporary Changes, Paycheck Protection Program Requirements, Corporate Groups, and Non-Bank and Non-Insured Depository Institution. And this was issued on April the 30th by the SBA. Now, this particular one, the non-bank and non-insured depository institution rules, are very interesting if you're one of those, probably not terribly interesting to most people listening to this today, unless you are one of those, then you really need to go find a, I guess, non-banking podcast to get more information about that. But let's talk about the other part of this. One of the issues this came out with, and probably doesn't affect most people listening to this, but may affect some, there has been a lot of press about corporate entities, or let's say corporate groups that formed a bunch of subsidiaries, and under the program, those subsidiaries each being able to qualify for their own $10 million loan. And in some cases, getting over $100 million in total loans for the group. Well, the Treasury has decided that, well, we really don't like that too much. So what Treasury is going to do is say, now, if you have a common parent, then you are limited to $20 million in total in loans. So every entity that traces its way back to the common parent is going to have to limit the total borrowing. Once we get to $20 million for that group with a common parent, nobody else can get another dollar from the program. Now, if the money was already dispersed before the effective date of this, then you're going to be able to keep that money, apparently. So those that got the 100 plus million apparently are fine, just nobody else will be able to. But if you don't have that much distributed today, or whatever you do have and the next dollar would be over that, all future distributions from the loan program have to be checked against the $20 million. It will be the responsibility of the borrower, not the responsibility of the lender, to double check this information. So it's going to be up to the borrower to understand if they have a common parent situation, and if they have a common parent, to ensure that no more than $20 million is taken for the entire group. So that's one for a few of you to deal with. We also had a little clarification here, which was kind of useful, but probably doesn't affect many people. It was a modification on the 29th of April to the Payroll Protection Program Loans Frequently Asked Questions on the SBA's website. Again, issued on the 29th. So this particular thing got updated multiple times. So we're going to talk about things were added on various days last week. This one was added on the 29th. And it said that what happened if let's say we have an operating restaurant, but on February 20th, we sold the restaurant. The restaurant is sold to another party. So I'm the buyer. I came in. I bought an operating restaurant. And either I bought the stock of the restaurant, maybe it's an S corporation, maybe I bought the assets, formed a new corporation. But in some way, shape, or form, I bought that restaurant after February 15th. Now, there is a requirement to be in business on January 1st, or by February 15th. So the problem is, if I'm a brand new corporation that was formed to hold this restaurant, can I still get a PPP loan? I mean, I'm still operating this restaurant that, let's say, has been in town for 40 years, but I just operated it my own S corporation because I bought the assets. And what we're told in this case is that actually the SBA is going to look at what we'd probably from a tax standpoint call substance over form. And they're going to say, no matter what the form of the purchase, it doesn't matter if you bought the stock, in which case then the corporation existed all along, or you bought the assets or whatever way you did it. We're looking at the substance over the form. And as long as that business was in operation on February 15th, it does not matter if the ownership of that business has changed in the interim. So again, it's looking at business. Now, this will become important because we're going to get to some guidance later where some people decided, well, it didn't really apply because it talked about a business owned by a private company. And I'm going to say, reading this, I get the feeling that SBA would consider a business to be separate from the entity that holds it. So in the SBA's idea, a business owned by a private company is not two separate entities, but rather it's simply like, you know, it would be just simply your S corporation that operates a business is going to be considered to be a business owned by a private entity. The business is the construction company you're running. The private entity is going to be the S corporation that's holding it. So that looks like how they're interpreting that, and that's consistent with how they word this and how they come across this and why they say it works the same. Okay, the fallout from the Ruth Chris story continues, and the Treasury is making lots of noises about people who got loans that they thought shouldn't have got them. And one of the things that came up this week was Secretary Mnuchin, in two interviews were conducted on the 28th. The first one was CNBC. He was on CNBC, and there he stated that every PPP loan that was in excess of $2 million would be subject to a specific review. They use the term audit. We get into that deal. As CPAs, I don't want to use the term audit. We don't mean a financial statement audit, but we do mean a detailed review of the loan, and in particular, looking at whether the loan should have been applied for in the first place. Remember, from last week's discussion, Treasury is looking they're interpreting a loan being necessary as meaning that the company did not have adequate liquidity either from current operations, from just what they had on hand, or from their access to credit to be able to have continuing operations. So they needed this money in order to fund their continuing operations in the interim. So they're going to be looking at every loan they claim. Now, this could be interesting because the SBA staff is not that big. So we'll have to see how they accomplish this. I suppose they could go out and hire outside CPA firms to go do reviews of all of these things, or some other expertise to come in and do an independent review after the bank's done their review. So, we'll see how that goes. But obviously, that kind of is telling the bank when they review the application from the borrower who's over $2 million, that their determination is not necessarily going to be rubber stamped, that it's going to go to SBA where there's going to be detailed requests for other information, and SBA will determine if the loan should have been made in the first place. And they're reviewing it at forgiveness because, well, practical matter is, they kind of, the problem occurred after the loans have been dispersed, and then the issue hit the press after that happened. So they really can't go fix the issue for the fact that the disbursements took place. So they're going to try to catch it on the forgiveness side. So that'll be for those in excess of $2 million. But in this particular joint statement by the secretary and the administrator of the SBA on the review procedure for Paycheck Protection Program loans, they also confirmed a statement that Secretary Mnuchin made later in the day in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, that other loans will also be selected for review. My concern is that they're going to ask for liquidity information on the forgiveness application, and they will then use that liquidity information could very well be used by the SBA to pull certain loans, even if they're below $2 million, and start following up to see if they were appropriate. So be aware that this particular issue, we're going to see these loans are going to be looked at. We also are told in that statement that regulations are to come to deal with this, but as of the time I'm recording this on Saturday morning, and I have to say when I recorded, because they actually issued last weekend guidance during the weekend. So, you know, there could be something coming right now, but right now it's just before 10 a.m. Mountain Standard Time here in Phoenix on Saturday morning. So, you know, we'll see what comes, if anything comes after that. And for those of you that get confused about Standard Time versus Daylight Time, yes, we are on Standard Time. That means we don't touch our clocks. That also means that if you want to think that I'm on the same time as Los Angeles, that's fine. But that's going to cause you a problem come November when Los Angeles and everybody there will move their clocks again, apparently, unless they actually get their wish to stay on Daylight Time. And then we'll just have the confusion that they're on Pacific Time, we're on Mountain Time, but our clocks both say the same thing, which is actually what's true right now. But nevertheless, we'll go there. Now, this brings us to the big thing that came out this week. And this was the update on the 28th of the Payroll Protection Program FAQ. Remember, last week we talked about question 31 being added to the FAQ, where they talked about for a public company with access to credit markets that, you know, that was their example of somebody who should not have applied for the loan because they had access to credit markets, they had adequate liquidity, they didn't need the loan. Now, some people read that and said, well, it's fine, we're not a public company, so it's not a problem. We don't have access to public credit markets, we're not a public company. The only thing to talk about is public company, we're okay. This week, they added a new question 37. And it talks and it says, if I am a private company that owns a business, you know, what are my concerns on liquidity? And they say, go look at question 31, which means the same issues apply. As the week wore on, Secretary Mnuchin specifically called out some private schools, well-off private schools with large endowments. And he said that it applied for and received the loan. And he specifically said that they need to pay it back. You know, they shouldn't have gotten the loan. They had sources of liquidity. They could spend the endowment. The fact they may not want to spend the endowment is different than they can't. The endowment would clearly carry them easily through any downturn. So he said they should not have gone to do that merely to preserve the endowment at the maximum level. And he wanted the money back. Suggestion is that they are looking at, you know, this liquidity issue keeps coming up and they're looking at it. And my guess is question 37 is a precursor to some sort of inquiry into liquidity that's going to be showing up on all the forgiveness applications. I hope I'm wrong about that. I hope they just look at ones, you know, that they think are obvious, but it wouldn't surprise me to see liquidity information included. What would liquidity information be? Could very well be things like, okay, what did your balance sheet look like, you know, when you applied for the loan? What was your cash in bank? What have your sales been before and after? You know, does it look like sales are there? What have your receivable collections been? I mean, obviously, your sales could be continuing, but if nobody's paying you, then, yeah, you got a problem. But if your sales have stayed the same and your liquidity and your receivables are still being paid, then it looks like operations, and Secretary Mnuchin did say this week as well, companies who have sufficient funds from operations to pay these things should be applying for this. So, you know, you can see them setting this up for liquidity test. So what have your, you know, what's your cash in bank going into this? What has your inflows been from operations? And I would say probably that would be all the way through to collection receivables. Do you have credit lines? Have those credit lines remained open? How much credit do you have access to on the credit line? You know, because remember, they said access to credit markets was also a key. So, like I say, don't be surprised. Do I know they're going to ask those things? No, clearly. I don't know what they're going to ask. But I am thinking that it's a risk that we may find that they're going to start asking for these things. And if they do so, then we're going to have some interesting problems coming up, right? That's going to be one of these little interesting aside things. Well, more things. This was another interim final regulation. And this was issued on the 27th. And this is the Small Business Administration Business Loan Program Temporary Changes, Paycheck Protection Program, Additional Criterion for Seasonal Employers. And if you looked at the law said if you're a seasonal employer, we can compute your 2.5 months worth of payroll, not by using a full year period, but we could use a 12-week period. And the law provided for two options for the 12-week period that you could use in lieu of the prior year if you were a seasonal employer. By the way, we've never seen a definition of seasonal employer yet, so that's also one of those other weird things. And it's also a little weird they're telling us now how to compute maximum loan funding when, you know, we already wiped out the first round. So if you're a seasonal employer and you're in the first round, you kind of, whatever they're telling you here isn't going to change what you got, and you can't go back and get more. So yeah, this is the guidance on the program has been late, very late to the game, and in many cases, after it would have reasonably been useful to many people, it's arriving. But the law says your 12-week period, which is probably what everybody tested on in the first round of funding, could either be 12 weeks beginning on February 15, 2019, or beginning on March 1, 2019 at the election of the borrower. Now, the SBA said, you know, some businesses are seasonal, and maybe their season is the summer, and none of these 12-week periods are really going to pick up their seasonal business. So they're saying, instead, we're going to allow you, in addition to the prior year or these two 12-week options, we're going to allow you to take any 12-week period between 5-1, May 1st of 2019, and September 15th of 2019, any consecutive 12 weeks in that period from the beginning of May to the middle of September, any 12 weeks there can be used for your for coming up with average payroll from which you'll take 2.5 months of that, and that will form your PPP loan. Now, the one interesting problem is if you do go into, let's say, the latter part of that period, it's going to be a little more interesting about how do you actually pay out that payroll. Now, if the numbers are low here right now, and that's kind of an interesting problem. But again, as I said, a lot of these seasonal employers that may have gotten funding in the first round, and you know, they never had a chance to use a second 12-week period. And to be frank, so did many here in the second round, because a lot of the second rounds are just carryovers of the applications that were already in place after the first round. So yeah, it's kind of a mess. Now, we have another thing here. We got a clarification of how you count 500 employees, because, you know, we have to worry about here about how we count 500 employees. And this is also from the frequently asked questions for the Payroll Protection Program loans. And this particular FAQ was one issued on April the 26th. And this added a question about, well, how do we count 500 employees? You know, on 500 employees, you know, or do we include only our full-time employees, or do we count our part-timers as well? And they said for the 500 employee test, remember, if you're above 500, you cannot get a PPP loan. You have to include all employees, both full-time and part-time. So the part-timers will come into the mix. So under the law, for the 500 employee test, you count both. But they remind you in this question, when we get to forgiveness, we swap to full-time equivalents. So for loan forgiveness, you need to maintain your FTE level instead of just worrying about, you know, full-time versus part-time and those numbers. You've got to be FTE. So it won't be good enough to maintain the same number of people if the hours drop so that the FTEs drop. So yeah, that'll get interesting. And by the way, we still don't really have a good definition of what's an FTE. You know, it's one of these little weird things that we just don't have a definition for yet. So for there, what we can do. Now, also, they issued a really nice long one that is virtually useless. Okay. This was the Paycheck Protection Program, how to calculate the maximum loans by business type, a new set of frequently asked questions, came out April the 24th. And what it does, it outlines how you compute maximum loan by entity type. And it goes through each one in order. So the first thing it tells us is a self-employed person with no employees. Well, that's very basic. Take their Schedule C from 19. If it's more than $100,000, just set it to $100,000. If it's less than 100,000, you'll use that lower number. You divide that by 12, multiply by 2.5, that is the max borrowing. Okay, simple, right? If the self-employed person has employees, you start with that same basic calculation. That's the entire amount of the loan that's going for the self-employed person's quote-unquote salary. And then you do the standard employee add back, right? We take all the employees' wages for the 12-month period. We add in the other payroll costs. And then we add that to what we have from the owner from Schedule C, divide by 12, multiply by 2.5. Note, that tells you right there that the funding of a retirement plan and paying of health insurance premiums do not count as payroll costs for the owner of a sole proprietorship. So that's an interesting aside. Again, we don't know much. We don't know much else. Now, they also clarified, because they had always said Schedule C. They clarified that, yeah, if you're a farmer filing Schedule F, use Schedule F. So that finally was made clear. There were some concerns because the original, the guidance just said Schedule C. And if you were dealing with a bank that didn't usually deal with farmers, you might have a real problem convincing a banker who's not really a tax return expert that Schedule F was the equivalent of Schedule C because you were a farmer. So, yeah, we got that clarified. We also got guidance on partnerships, how they calculate. And this one was a little more interesting. In a partnership, you take, for the partners, the net income from self-employment, and you adjust it for the 179s, and you adjust it for unreimbursed partner expenses that they're claiming, though, which are things the partnership may not know. They're going to have to get that from the partner. And then you multiply that number by 0.9235, which at first say, okay, that makes sense. We do that on Schedule SE, except we don't do that for the sole proprietor. And there's no explanation why partners have that reduction, but sole proprietors don't. They tell you why partners have it, because it's to take out the employer FICA, but they don't actually tell you why sole proprietors don't have that taken out, except they don't. So, interesting problem there. And then the partners, then we go very similar to sole proprietors. Everybody else, we go to the regular employees, add those in, do the same thing. Corporations, we just don't have we don't have an owner per se. The owner is going to be an employee. So everybody just uses their employment income, again, capped at 100 grand. We add in the health insurance. We add in the retirement plan. We do whatever other adjustments are necessary. And that's how we get our max at 2.5 months. They also tell us how to handle nonprofits filing 990. Pretty similar. You're going to be using, their payroll. Certain other organizations, which would be like religious institutions, like churches, don't file 990s or aren't required to. So, they still tell them how they can file, how veterans organizations and tribal businesses can file. Again, basically, it's going to be based on the W-2s. We'll have that back in the mix as to how they will file. They tell us how LLCs should apply. SBA says follow the tax classification. If your LLC is a disregarded entity and it's owned by an individual, use individual guidance. If your LLC is a disregarded entity, it's owned by a corporation, use the corporate guidance. If your LLC is owned by a partnership and it's a disregarded entity, use the partnership guide. If your LLC has more than one owner and you use the default generally, which is a partnership, then use partnership. If you've elected to be a corporation and you didn't make an S election, or whether you did or didn't, use corporate guidance, right? So we don't worry about that. They also give a list of information, other information beyond just what they tell them we'd normally use that would be acceptable for the loan. So if you're having issues with the bank, question 9 is pretty good about telling them other things that would be able to do that. It also covers another issue like Schedule F. Some people reported problems because, the banks wanted wanted 941s, and this was a small business filing a 944 annually. They explained to the banks that 944 is going to be equivalent to 941. If a business is told they have to file 944, they won't be filing 941s. So ask for 944. Okay, things like that. So it cleans that up. The bad news is maximum borrowing, that would have been wonderful to know 3 weeks before this was issued. They issued it 3 weeks after the loan program opened. That is not a hopeful sign for how quickly we're going to get the forgiveness guidance for the 8-week period. So be aware, you're probably going to be flying blind Well, you've already been flying blind for some period. A lot, you know, if you got funded early in the program, you've already been flying blind for a while. You're going to be flying blind probably for a large part of the 8 weeks if you got in early. Because I'm not sure how quickly the SBA will actually get the guidance out. I would love to find out when I get done with this that they have posted the guidance and we have detailed guidance on what counts for forgiveness. But I'm not going to be holding my breath that that's what's going to happen today when I check out of this, that we will have that guidance. If we do get it, I will reference it on the Current Federal Tax Development's website when it comes down. So you may want to keep a watch there. We've been posting things there as things have happened all week. That's why this week's PDF is, I thought last week was long. This one's even longer in terms of information. So there are tons of things happening going on. I did an update this week for New Jersey Society of CPAs on COVID-19. We spread it over 2 days. So, you know, people just could take four hours in a day or choose one day or the other. First day concentrated on business, second day concentrated some only on individuals, but picked up some at remaining business topics. And the funny part was that I was actually making changes between the 2 days to the slides and was actually making changes all the way up to an hour before the session because we got four different things coming out after I finished the session the first day and before I started the session the next. Things are coming out very, very rapidly. The only problem is on the SBA side, they are way behind. And so while they're coming out quickly now, there are things we need to know 3 weeks ago. That's our problem currently, and I'm not sure that's going to get better anytime soon. Now on to the IRS. Hey, taxes. We have to have something tax-related this week. The IRS made some additional entries on the temporary procedures to fax certain forms 1139 and 1045 due to COVID-19. This is the May 1st, 2020 version issued on May the 1st, right? We've got that. Now, mainly what we discussed before, they had updated the list for some 1139 issues, but they didn't add 1045. Well, some people thought maybe they'd do something like allow us to fax in 1040Xs, right? Because they told us we couldn't fax in 1120Xs, but didn't say anything about 1040Xs. If you thought that was why it was done, you're going to be disappointed. What they mainly did was put 1040X, 1045s back in, which is, you know, in there. They did add a lot of information regarding amended returns. They tell us, you know, they repeated that for 1045s, it would be like Form 1139. If a 1040X needs to be processed, so let's say, you know, you have a 1040X that's changing or creating NOL in 2018, then you're going to carry that 2018 NOL back 5 years. That 1045 that carries it back for 5 years cannot be processed until the 1040X that creates the NOL is processed and in the system. And no, you can't fax it in, so, you know, we're kind of stuck with that as we go. But they do clarify and added beyond what they told us for 1139. Okay, so I'm in that situation. I have to amend 18. That's going to create an NOL. The NOL goes back 5 years. Now, I'm on a deadline for 18's 1045 or 1139, because, you know, it has to be filed by June 30. And I guarantee you an amended return going in today will not be processed by June 30. So the catch is if I've got to wait until I know it's been processed to file the carryback, I'm going to have to do a 1040X for every year. So I'm going to end up past that June 30 date. The IRS makes clear that, you know, basically, you know, you timely file the hard copy. You adhere to the deadlines in that case. And, you know, if you do that, go ahead and send in, you know, the temporary procedures. Notate on the fax cover page that you file. If you e-file 1120X when it was accepted, if it's a 1045, you know, 1040, you'll notify that. They will notify you in that issue. They added that, yeah, the timing for refunds, they make it clear, don't expect the 45-day time period to work, right? These will be processed due to IRS just changes logistically in processing, the fact that people aren't there, the fact that they are way behind in getting to mail now. It's going to take forever to slog through. The 1045s will be, they'll try to speed those up, but they may not get them processed as quickly as you'd like. So be aware of that. Don't tell clients don't try to spend that money real quick. It's going to take a while to get in. And they also clarified they will not be establishing any fax procedures for any carrybacks of net operating losses for not-for-profits from a 990T. They said, sorry, guys, or for the minimum tax issue, there's not going to be any special fax procedure for that. Those will have to be done the old-fashioned way, which may not be thrilled about. Now, the news that got lots of coverage, and probably one of the most controversial things that has come out recently, came out on the 30th of April, late on the 30th of April, notice 2020-32. Okay. We had had a question about, you know, the PPP loan. We know when it's forgiven, Congress told us, Section 1106I of the CARES Act, that that forgiveness is not taxable income. But they didn't say anything about whether you could still deduct the expenses that were paid for with that money. Honestly, Congress should have said that, right? Made it clear. Because it does seem absurd that you would go out of your way to say the amount's not taxable income and not intend for a deduction to be taken for the expenses paid. Because otherwise, had you just left it in, you know, and said it's taxable income, well, we had to have these expenses, which will all be deductible expenses, or I think almost all would be, in order to have had the forgiveness. So that would wash out to zero. If we say it's not taxable, we can't deduct the expenses, that washes out to zero, so it'd make no difference. But the IRS took a look at the history. Our problem here is, are these deductions related to an item of tax-exempt income? And the IRS looked at that history, Section 265A, which I have, you know, quoted in the materials that we wrote up this week. And it tells us no deduction is going to be allowed for any item of expense that relates to the tax-exempt income. And looking at this, the IRS decided that actually that's going to block it, that these deductions that you use, these expenses you're using to create the forgiveness of indebtedness, relate to that income because you're saying you use that money for these purposes. And because of that, they're then going to turn around and say, well, tough luck, 265A1 blocks the deductions. They cite a series of court cases to back this up and rulings, and they're in the materials. The day after they did this, a couple of places, there were questions posed immediately by the Wall Street Journal to Senate Finance Committee Chairman Grassley, and the next day posed by Tax Notes to Ways and Means Committee Chairman Neal. Now, Ways and Means Committee Chairman Neal has said that he is going to be working on a legislative fix in the next round of legislation to reverse this decision. Senator Grassley said that he was disappointed in the decision, but he neither, in talking to the Wall Street Journal, it was noted that Senator Grassley, declined to comment on whether he would back a legislative fix to do it. And the next day, when Tax Notes asked, it was the same thing. He said it's a bad decision, we don't like it, but he refused to comment on a legislative fix. Now, I don't know. The problem is with Congress and politics, you have no idea what that means. Does it mean that they don't want to touch, that Senator Grassley, and I would have to assume he's listening to Republican leadership in the Senate, don't want to touch the PPP program? And they figure if you open it up, it's going to open up a whole can of worms for everything about the program. So are they going to try to pressure Treasury into withdrawing this ruling and issuing a reversal and one that's just different? Is it just a negotiating ploy? But it seems difficult if, in fact, the IRS doesn't reverse for Senator Grassley politically to oppose a fix. So not sure what it means or why he's not saying he'll have one. But that is interesting. And Ways and Means says we're going to have a fix. So Ways and Means is looking at doing it legislatively. Senator Grassley is saying it's a bad decision. He doesn't like it, but he's not committing to a fix. So keep your eye on this space is what I'll say. I'm not sure. Again, remember the last round we had the back and forth of negotiations, and a lot of it's posturing. And when it actually gets serious, they'll come down and do it. By the way, we do have one complication. You notice this time, we haven't been told how rapidly the money's going away. Well, this morning, Senator Rubio complained on Twitter, because that's where everything happens. He complained that, you know, the SBA has not been giving them that information, and he wants it. So not sure why Treasury has stopped telling us how much has been submitted, how much has been approved, but that hasn't been given. That's why you're not hearing right now how quickly it's running out of money. And that's why you're also not hearing about, oh, we got to refund it immediately. Now, I don't know if it's intentional that Treasury just doesn't want to have that conversation, or some other people don't want that conversation being had. But it certainly appears that, the chair of the Small Business Committee in the Senate does want that conversation to be had. So keep an eye on that. We'll see if that gets fixed. Next up, remember we have all these changes to the payroll tax forms or payroll taxes, and we need to have a 941 change? Well, the IRS on the 30th released the initial draft of the Employer's Quarterly Federal Tax Return Form 941 for 2020. And this will be an April 2020 revision, right? It is a version that, you know, revises the 941. You'll use it in the second quarter. In fact, the funny part is it's got the first quarter box shaded out. So when it asks which quarter, it still says first quarter on the 941, but the box is actually shaded so you can't use it. It's kind of interesting. Like, no, you're not supposed to use this first quarter, so don't try. What this adds, it adds a page and adds items dealing with the credit for qualified sick and family leave wages. Remember, that program started on April the 1st. Also starting on April the 1st, or actually starting on March 12th, was the employee retention credit. Now, we were told on the first quarter 941 that if we had ERC from the first quarter, that we should treat that as a credit in the second quarter, which meant effectively on April 1st you got the credit, which then meant you could file the 7200 immediately to get that money back. So that's there, we'll deal with that. The one we never really got good guidance on was what to do about the deferral if you had any amounts that you were depositing after March 27th and before April 1st. If you had deposits in that period, you know, how did we deal with the fact you were supposed to defer the taxes? And as I recall, we never got, they claimed they were going to give us instructions how to do it, but I don't recall ever actually seeing those instructions. Somebody has correction for that, let me know, but I don't recall seeing it. Now, they also issued 17 pages of draft instructions on this form. So you go check of that. One interesting thing that was there that was not clear in the law, but it appears clear, Treasury is going to let you, via using what I call a Nike election, just do it, is going to let you opt out of deferring the employer portion of old age, survivor, and disability insurance, and what they just call Social Security tax here. Remember, we have the right to defer that. Even if you get a PPP loan, you can still defer it until you got forgiveness. But what if you are, I don't want to have this big bill due in December of 21. I've got the cash to pay it now. I just want to pay it. And I don't want to be tracking that mess either. You officially can skip doing it. The guidance says if you actually deposit those taxes, you're not going to be allowed to get a refund of them. Now, I read that and read it again as trying to figure out how in the world they're going to stop that, because how do they know I'm overpaid that I paid those taxes, not something else? Not really clear to me how they're going to know what they're refunding. But in any event, you're not allowed to do that, is what they're saying. They're going to keep it. I do know that at least ADP had been offering the option to their customers to opt to do it or not. I had heard about them doing that a few days before this came out. I don't know if they got advance notice that the IRS was going to do it this way or if they just guessed they'd allow it. But in any event, yes, you're allowed to do that. So we know for sure that is allowed. There is no problem on that site. If you download the materials, we have a copy of the actual form 941 as revised. So that's there on the download page. So you can take a look at that. Also, we have the links that can get you to the actual form. Now, next up, we have more filing and payment deadline questions and answers. The IRS revised its facts on these issues. And the IRS had extended filings with the tax court in Notice 2023 under IRC Section 7508 Cap A's authority. That said, if you had a 90-day letter coming due between April 1st of 2020 and July 14th of 2020, you would be timely if you filed with the tax court by July 15th. But in 2016, in the Gurnick, and I'm mispronouncing the gentleman's name, versus Commissioner case, 146 TC 230, the tax court dealt with a case where a petition was due to the tax court on a day when the tax court was closed, you know, because of a snow emergency in D.C. And there the court ruled that if the clerk's office is closed, the deadline for filing moves to the next day. And some were saying, well, the tax court office is closed right now and we have this ruling. Which rule do we follow? And so the IRS clarified that you will follow the later of those two dates. If on July 15th of 2020, the tax court offices are still closed, let's say, because of the condition of the Corona 19 virus in the DC area, let's say it's really bad then, and so everything's shut down. If that's still going on, then you'll go until that ends. Or if the IRS extends this relief, then maybe it would go beyond the date the tax court reopens. So basically, you're going to look for the later of these two dates for filing a tax court petition. Finally, the IRS and Department of Labor extended the deadline for certain employee benefit timeframes, right? And what they're doing, this is a announcement from both agencies, the Internal Revenue Service Department of Labor, official title, extension of certain timeframes for employee benefit plans, participants, and beneficiaries affected by the COVID-19 outbreak, right? It extends various timeframes. Under ERISA or the Internal Revenue Code, with an employee benefit program, and it may be a retirement plan, it could be a health care plan, it could be another type of welfare benefit plan. But sometimes, you know, like if you file a claim and if you're denied, there's a certain time frame you're allowed to protest that. If you are terminated from your, you know, let's say you have a issue that arises that causes you to go on to cause you to be eligible for COBRA coverage. You know, you have a time frame to ask, 60 days to ask for COBRA coverage, right? There, and if you have a certain lifetime events under HIPAA, you're allowed to, even though there's not an open enrollment period for the healthcare plan and you didn't go into it, you are allowed, in essence, have to reopen it for a period of time, 30 days or 60 days after certain events occurs. For example, 30 days after the birth of a child, they have to reopen this to allow the employee to put the child, you know, basically to put themselves and the child on the program. So the problem is, due to COVID-19, it's very possible that either the plan or the employee may be unable to meet those deadlines. So what they've done is they've listed, and they list a series of options here. You want to check this out. It's in our materials that you can download on the website. But for the things they list, for any time frame that's running, you're going to ignore the period from March 1st, 2020 until either 60 days after the announced end of the national emergency under the Stafford Act. Remember, that was announced on the 13th of March. It's still in place as of today, the day I'm recording this, the 2nd of May. You know, theoretically, it could be ended today, but most likely it won't. And, you know, but, and even if it was, we'd still go 60 days out from that. Or later, the departments could announce a different date. And what they said was that it's very possible that maybe, you know, it's determined that some areas of the country are on a different time frame. So maybe some areas of the country are going to see a substantial decrease in transmission, going to see a substantial decrease in the number of people hospitalized, number of people who are becoming infected, and they're going to believe that now, you know, the average person who's infected is not going to be able to transmit the disease to very many, to basically they're going to transmit it to less than one, significantly less than one person. And the way exponential work growth is pretty easy. If the virus can only go to less than one person, rapidly in a few generations, it's going to die out because that's going to just keep whacking the numbers for each new generation. Flip side of that, of course, is if the average person transmits it to three people, that gets us, you know, exponential numbers going the other way. Exponential takes things up or down depending upon whether you're above or below one. For this, how many people would you infect? So mechanically, maybe some parts of the country are sitting there and it's very clear that their rate is somewhere, let's say, around 0.4, and this other part of the country is at 3. Well, the 0.4 part, you feel like it's safe to reopen. There's going to be very little transmission. You know, they've gone through the whole thing. They probably have herd immunity, and, you know, we're going to let that section open. This other part where we're running out of, well, let's say we now do have a major crisis developed here that looks like northern Italy, and, you know, they're running out of beds, et cetera, that part's going to stay under emergency. Well, if we have that situation, then the Department of Labor and IRS would look at saying, look, okay, the period's just ended for this place that now appears to have no problem, but we're going to extend the period for the, you know, for this small area that has this huge problem, okay? And they could set that date. Now, what this means is, though, that let's take an example here of, which they have one of these examples. You have an employee after, let's say, like March 30th, an employee gives birth to a child. Now, that triggers the HIPAA enrollment period. Okay. However, since that's within the March 1st to the 60-day end period, that person will not have to tell you that they want to go on the plan until 60 days after the emergency ends or the other date that's later set. Now, if that's the case, and here's the other catch, they will be retroactively covered because they always got coverage back to date of birth, you know, if they came in. So they could be retroactively covered. So anything that happens after the child was born would be covered. So if that's the case, they can do that, and then they'll be able to pay up the premiums. You know, they could tell you, so let's say, by definition, it has to be at least 60 days from today. And if they if it's not been declared, we haven't said disaster is over, you know, the disaster declaration has been wiped out, if we don't have that said by the time you listening to this, you are, you know, it's 60 days from the day you're listening to this, the earliest this could happen. Well, they're going to have at least that much time if the period hadn't ended. And let's say, like this, in this case, with the person that gave birth during the period, that person is going to have another 60 days, another 30 days after the 60 days. So that person will not have to make a decision until 90 days from at the earliest today, and most likely a number of days after today. So look at that. They have a number of examples of how this is going to work for different things like appeals of decisions on benefits, filing claims, other rules. So you want to check that. One thing that has not changed, though, the employer's requirement to give COBRA notices is not affected by this. They have to still meet the same time frames. Okay, it's been tiring, but that's it. We are doing real old-fashioned, not really old-fashioned because we're not in the room together. We're doing standard old CPE. As I said, this past week I did sessions. We did it as 2 4s. It was really the one course, but broken into 2 halves, so it was 2 4s. We did that for the New Jersey Society of CPAs. We actually did it on Zoom, which was interesting. And we had, you know, we had a decent number, you know, let's say, you know, a very decent number of people showing up, shall we say, for this. So it was nice, and it was a nice full group. And we got questions answered and back and forth. So that's going on. We are going to be doing that same course. And actually, right now, I believe we've got it booked 4 other times. One of those times is coming out a bit down the line, so we'll talk about that later. They're hoping everything's, I think that state society is hoping that everything's calmed down by the time we get there, so the course doesn't change every day, because literally this course has changed every day this week. But you want to sign up for it? The Arizona Societies of CPAs will be running a session this week on May the 7th. It will be broadcast. My understanding is we are going to be using, you know, the standard type of broadcast they're using, that they usually use for their sessions. So, I mean, we'll be doing it via Zoom, but we'll be doing it through the same type of interface that you see. We're going to be working with the Cal CPA broadcast group to take care of that, just like they usually do. So that'll be an 8-hour session on the 7th, beginning at 8 in the morning, running to 3:30. Right, standard 8-hour session, standard rules. We're going to go over COVID. We're going to go over all of the CARES Act and other things that have happened since basically you took your tax update. That's how I kind of phrase it. All the stuff since you took that tax update in November, we're going to cover now. That will talk a little bit at the end of the day about the SECURE Act. Remind you, that's still there, and we still have that. We're going to spend most of the day on the business issues in the CARES Act and the prior things that took place. So we're looking at, you know, all, you look at the sick pay, we're looking at the family leave mandate, We'll look at the other issues. How we plan to cover this is start with, as I did in New Jersey, start with the payroll tax issues. Go on to the loan, PPP loan, with whatever we know at that point in time. So we'll be full coverage of PPP loan. We'll talk a little bit about EIDG grants. Those are beginning to trickle out now. And so we'll talk a little bit about those. But to a large extent, the EIDL, EIDG program doesn't have a direct tax impact, except that the grants reduce your PPP borrowing. We'll talk about that briefly. But the PPP loan is really entwined with these payroll tax benefits. So we have to understand both of those. And we'll talk about the PPP loans. We'll talk about the other items that were in the law. We'll talk about the advance payments for the individuals. We'll talk about the various things that were in the business section of the law in addition to the payroll taxes. So we'll talk about the patches, the QI, qualified investment property, et cetera, all that stuff. And we'll talk a little bit at the end about the things that are still there from the SECURE Act that we're going to have to take care of at the same time this year we take care of all these other things that have just been recently added. So that's on May 7th for Arizona. Idaho Society, we will do it as an 8-hour course, but broken over 2 days, so much like we did in New Jersey, 4 hours one day, 4 hours the next. You can sign up at the Idaho Society. There you will sign up for both days together. Is how you do it, but it'll be there for COVID-19. Then the Washington Society will also run this on May the 27th. There will be a standard 8-hour session for the day, so we'll run that. That'll be just after, right? Just shortly after Memorial Day. So again, now, we're probably, you think at May 27th, we're sitting here at May 2nd today when I'm recording this, May 4th when this officially posts. You would think that we'd have things settled by then. I'm thinking it's at best even money that we will have the 8-week guidance by the time that session comes. I hate to say it. So we'll still be talking about what can you do, and we talk about that in the session. What can you advise people today who are already in the middle of an 8-week period? What's the game plan? What do we need to be ready for? And we'll talk a bit about that. But again, those three sessions are up and running. We'll have another one coming later into the summer. So be aware for that and keep your eye on it. But all of those can be signed up for at the respective State Society of CPA websites. So you can find all of that. Otherwise, we've had a lot going up on CurrentFederalTaxDevelopments.com website. And I suspect that will continue to happen because we are still really waiting for that forgiveness guidance from the SBA that someday will come out, we assume. So watch that site, see what's happening there. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle there is @edzollers. Also follow discussions. I look at Reddit /r/taxpros. I've been so busy these days, so I haven't had a lot of time to look in there because I've been juggling a whole bunch of other things going on, including the course, getting materials ready, and keeping up with all the changes. It's been kind of a real mess. But I also do follow the discussions on the Connect groups for the Arizona Society of CPAs, New Jersey Society of CPAs, and Minnesota. And I also, keep an eye on the Tax Talk group of Cal CPA. So we take a look there, talk about what's going on. So lots of places those discussions are going on. If you have access to such a site, and everybody here has access to Tax Pros if you're a tax pro, and everybody here has access to Cal CPA's Tax Talk if you are a licensed CPA attorney, and I believe it's been expanded to EA now in the U.S., right? You can get into it. You just have to let Jim Counts know your status, and he'll let you in. So you have access. These have been extremely useful places to bounce ideas off people regarding these things, to try to deal with, and to keep up with the news when something breaks to figure out what's happening. So it's really helpful to look at those sites. As I say, I fully expect next week to be a busy week as well. So we'll keep our eyes on what comes out of the Small Business Administration, what comes out of the IRS and Treasury, whether we start negotiations on a new bill that may have the patch to let us deduct those expenses that we are going to pay with PPP loan proceeds. So we got lots of things to watch for, lots of things we need guidance on. And so I probably will have a lot to talk about to you a week from today. So check back in next week here on Current Federal Tax Developments.